I'd like to call to order the October 9th meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. Before you use an agenda of today's meeting, are there any questions or comments about the agenda? If not, we'll move forward with the meeting agenda as presented. Our next step is the approval of the September 11th meeting minutes. Do I hear a motion moved by Ms. Hines? And seconded?
Second.
Okay, it was seconded already. Mr. Bulger seconded it. Any other questions, discussion? If not, all approved?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the meeting minutes are approved. Today's agenda is a very full one with four action and five information items before us. We'll be asked to approve revisions to the Fairfax County Parking Surcharge Agreement, as well as a revised budget for the Potomac Yards Station project. We'll also hear about bus procurements for the DC Circulator, the new Carrollton Yard improvements, where we'll be asked to approve the funding and public hearings respectively. On the information side, Mr. Kanaan will provide an update on the progress to implement the board's strategic plan momentum. A lot of progress has been made, and in fact, one of the action items is the first project to use down payment of the $75 million provided by Governor O'Malley, Governor McAuliffe, and Mayor Gray. We'll also hear from our general manager, Rob Troop, on recent business progresses and focus on our upcoming business plan to further advance momentum. Our CFO, Dennis Anisak, and his finance team will lead a discussion of our rail ridership and update us on actions being taken to comply with the financial management oversight report. So today we have a very busy meeting, and let's start with the first action item, which is Mr. Anisak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie Stanwall, Director for Real Estate and Strategic Station Planning, will present the first item.
Thank you. This afternoon, staff is seeking board approval to authorize the general manager to execute revisions to Fairfax County's parking surcharge agreement as agreed to in the 2011 Silver Line Phase 2 Memorandum of Agreement. As background, the parking surcharge program was created in 1988 by the board to provide funding for parking facilities at Metro Rail stations. In addition to the Fairfax agreement, there are also separate surcharge agreements for Prince George's County and for Montgomery County. This table provides a summary of the current surcharge fees, balances, and remaining debt relating to the three surcharge agreements. In Fairfax County, three garages were financed with support of the surcharge agreement: Huntington, Vienna 1, and Vienna 2. Huntington and Vienna 1 obligations have been paid, and only an $11 million balance associated with Vienna 2 garage remains. And currently there's a $23 million balance in the surcharge fund for Fairfax County. For Silver Line Phase 1, a parking garage was constructed at the Wheelie Reston East Station, and that garage is owned and operated by Fairfax County. The parking fee is currently set at the same rate as other parking garages in Virginia. However, it could be higher or lower. Parking revenues from the Wheelie garage flow to Fairfax County, not to WMATA. WMATA owns and maintains access and revenue collection at that garage, and we receive an administration fee to cover those expenses for those equipment. As part of the 2011 Memorandum of Agreement for Silver Line Phase 2, WMATA agreed to negotiate changes to the Fairfax County Surcharge Agreement to provide additional parking for parking garages at the Phase 2 part of the Silver Line. In accordance with this agreement, WMATA will continue to set base fees at the WMATA-owned parking facilities, with Fairfax County setting fees at the county-owned facilities. WMATA will have no operating and maintenance responsibility at these new garages, except for revenue collection if requested, similar to the arrangement at Wheelie Reston East. All surcharge revenues that are not required to support the existing debt will transfer to Fairfax for financing parking expansion. To enable Fairfax County to move forward with bond validation and construction of the Silver Line Phase 2 garages, staff recommends that the board grant approval for the general manager to execute revisions to the Fairfax County parking surcharge agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Are there any questions about this matter?
If not,
Ms. Hudgens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move with the staff's recommendation that we renew the agreement for the surcharge with the Fairfax County.
Thank you. Do I hear a second? It has been seconded by Mrs. Hines. Any other questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? This resolution passes. Next up is the DC Circulator Bus Procurement, and this will be Mr. Requa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In March, we came before you to and received authorization to buy assist the district in buying 13 buses for them to expand the circulator service on the mall. Since that time, the D.C. City Council has authorized funding for extensions of D.C. circulator service to current routes, the Union Station to Navy Yard, extension from Navy Yard to Waterfront, and extensions on the Union Station to Georgetown route up Wisconsin Avenue to the National Cathedral. To provide that additional service, five additional buses are requested, and the district has asked us to get authorization to assist them in making that purchase. So today we're recommending that an increase to the capital reimbursable budget by $4,061,357, an authorization for us to purchase the buses with the necessary services to do that in support of the DC circulator. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for staff? Mrs. Hines?
Just really for clarification, Jack, does this have any impact on WMATA's budget? I note it says that in the report that it's a direct competition with service we provide already.
The purchase of the buses is fully funded by all inspection services and administrative services are funded. I mean, there is a potential. The services that are without any adjustments to our service, it does both of these extensions do run over WMATA routes. There probably be with some adjustment in ridership from ourselves to them. I mean, we have 10 routes that serve National Cathedral. They'll have one. So I don't imagine that we'll lose a lot, but these are competitive services.
I would just say in the future, you know, where there is there is potentially an operating budget impact from reduction in ridership, that somehow that should just be noted. I'm not objecting. Yeah. I understand. I mean, we've taken routes over and we've overlapped some.
Right.
And it's just really a matter of being clear that there's a potential impact, although albeit small.
Yeah, it'll be minor, but there probably will be some impact.
Thank you. Any other questions?
If I could, I just wanted to thank Mr. Requa and his staff for the help over the years with circulator and streetcar. I understand the concern that Ms. Hines raised. We recently put out a circulator transit development plan. Our goal here is to complement the services provided by Metro, and I'll continue to work with Jack and the rest of the Metro board to ensure that's possible. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I entertain a motion to approve the resolution before you. Mr. Belger has moved. Second. Anybody would like to second? Ms. Porter had seconded it. All in favors?
Aye.
Any opposed? The resolution passes. Next up is the approval to hold a public hearing for the new Carrollton Yard Capacity Program. Mr. Thomas.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Pleasure to be here today to talk to you about the next two actions. The first is for the new Carrollton Yard expansion project. This fiscal year, the three jurisdictions have provided $75 million of additional funding as a down payment towards the car train program. One of the things that we're going to do with that is expand rail yards because we're hoping to exercise the option in the 7,000 series contract to buy 220 additional rail cars. We've identified two projects, rail yard projects, to accommodate those additional cars. The first one we're here to talk with you about is New Carrollton. We're proposing at New Carrollton Yard to put in 15 additional tracks, two additional buildings, and renovation of two existing buildings at that yard. We have to require property from both Amtrak and the state of Maryland for this expansion. One of the functions that are in that yard today, our track and structures department will be displaced by the expansion of the storage at New Carrollton, so we're proposing to give them a replacement facility at Landover Station. So the magnitude of the project and the property acquisition is what triggers the need for us to have a compact public hearing. The next two slides show graphics of what we're proposing. The existing yard is sort of faded in the background. You can see that up towards the top is some of the yard, additional yard storage tracks were proposed, and that's what triggers the need for the Amtrak property acquisition. Right in the center of the yard are an additional set of tracks. It's those tracks and the building associated with that that causes the displacement of the existing functions in the yard, which will move to Landover, which is shown on the next slide. So we're proposing to at Landover on WMATA-owned property, both undeveloped property as well as existing surface parking lot, to build a building there for the group that we call CTEM, and they're responsible for maintenance of the yellow equipment, all the track and structures equipment, as well as provide space in this building for track and structures. Since we're occupying a portion of the existing surface lot at this station, over on the left-hand side of the graphic, you see that there's a new parking garage to account for the displacement of that current revenue parking at this station. So we're here to recommend that the board approval to have a public hearing for these improvements at both New Carrollton Yard and at Landover Station.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Are there any questions of staff? Sure. Mr. Boulder.
Additional question. On the slide for the New Carrollton Yard improvements, it looks like that's about it. You crammed everything into that parcel of land. I mean,
This will be it at New Carrollton Yard.
Okay.
Yes.
It doesn't look like there's any more room.
No, that, in fact, that's why we're having to acquire property from both Amtrak and Maryland, because we've taken everything that we have and we got to pump a little bit bigger.
Just wanted to clarify. Thanks.
Are there any other questions for staff? Not, I'd entertain a motion to approve this resolution before us. So it's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The resolution passes. Next up is the approval of the revised budget for the Potomac Yards Station project.
So for Potomac Yards Station, we're here for asking for approval to increase the project budget. Since it's a reimbursable project, we're also asking for approval to increase the FY15 capital reimbursable program budget. We're working in a partnership with the City of Alexandria on preparing an environmental impact statement for a new infill station in Potomac Yard between National and Braddock Airport, Braddock Road stations. We've had some challenges as we're preparing the EIS. We've got two co-lead agencies, federal agencies, FTA and the National Park Service. So we've had to do a deeper analysis, for lack of a better description, on the EIS. We've had to add another option as a mitigation effort as part of the EIS, and as a result of the additional work that we're doing, the cost of preparing the EIS has gone up. Which is what's triggering the need for us to come back and ask the board for approval on the increase of the budget. The next slide is just a simple graphic that shows the study area. The stations will go, one of the stations, assuming if we can get a build alternative, will go right about in the middle of that graphic, about midpoint between National and Braddock, as I said. So, next slide. So we're here to ask for approval to increase the reimbursable project budget for Potomac Yard Station from $4.6 million to $5.2 million, and to increase the FY15 capital reimbursable budget from $88.1 to $88.7 million.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Are there any questions? Mrs. Hines?
Mr. Costa, if Mayor Yule was here, he would be saying that this is their top priority in terms of transportation improvements in the City of Alexandria, and that he much appreciates the work WMATA has been doing to support them in this, and would urge us all to vote for it.
Thank you. Mr. Bulger?
Just an informational question. I can't make out on the slide for where the EIS is. Study area, is there a parking facility envisioned at this new infill station?
No, this isn't envisioned to be an urban station.
Okay.
With no parking.
Okay.
With the development the city's doing, they expect this to be a walk-up station.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Goldman.
Two additional informational questions. Does the $5.2 million budget, does that reflect the average cost of an above-ground station? Is there some model out there as to what stations cost to build?
The budget that we're working with the city is up to $250 million for the total project budget. This is just the project budget for preparing the environmental impact statement.
So the actual cost will be in the range of about $250 million?
Yes.
And what's the timetable?
We expect to have a draft environmental impact statement out shortly after the first of the year. When that is published, we'll actually come back to the board January, February to ask for approval to hold a WMATA compact public hearing. The expectation is to close the public hearing process and the NEPA process maybe this time next year, and then start a procurement for a design-build contract. I would expect if that schedule holds, we'll be looking at probably somewhere in 2019 for a station opening.
So the construction would start 2017?
I would expect at best late 2016, starting in 17, yes.
About two and a half year construction?
Somewhere around there, 900 days is what I'm thinking.
Thank you. Any other questions? Dot, I'd entertain a motion to approve the resolution before us. And we have it has been moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The resolution passes. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Next up are a series of informational items. The first one is an update on our Momentum strategic plan, and we have Mr. Kanon to make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. In June of 2013, we brought forward to the board for adoption Momentum, the strategic plan, which would guide this authority's actions over the next time period through 2025. And there were two parts of that. And it's important to know that that not only contained the blueprint for the capital programs that would allow Metro to support this region's prosperity through the next dozen years, but it also laid out strategies and priority actions that we within Metro would conduct to make sure that we were the sleekest and most optimized organization in order to effect the capital program as well as the operational strategies. I'm here to report to you today the contents of the update report, which was issued to you earlier this calendar year, and announced that we've made significant strides towards both aspects of the strategic plan. We're going to talk about how far we've come and also how far we need to go in order to accomplish the goals that this board laid out for us to achieve. Now, one overarching goal of any strategic plan is to effect alignment within an organization and make sure that all the pieces of the puzzle are moving in the right direction. And the good news is that immediately after the adoption of the strategic plan, the general manager kicked off a budget process internally to make sure that all of the departmental business plans were in fact constructed around the strategic goals and the 86 priority actions that were laid out within that strategic plan. The Chief Performance Officer, in conjunction with the Office of Management Budget Services, also created a structure by which these departmental business plans were to be guided by the strategic plan and then evaluated against achieving these strategies. So the good news here is that we are, in fact, in alignment. There was a near 100% overlap between the priority actions laid out in the strategic plan and the departmental business plans. And then at the end of this, after the reporting cycle for the report, at the end of FY14, we can announce that that number is now 100% because of the monies that Metro is able to earn from the resiliency grant, the $21 million that we were recently awarded. So it came in after the fiscal year deadline, but we'd like to close that gap by that 99% and make it 100%. What we're going to do over the next few slides is dive a little bit deeper into what that means to us as an organization. I'm going to walk you through each one of the four goals and give you highlights from the report, which was extensive, about the progress that we're making towards the internal workings at Metro to accomplish the goals in the strategic plan. You'll see that we within Metro at the staff level are doing our part to be good financial stewards, to promote a culture of safety, to make sure that we're exceeding customers' expectations, and to better connect the region through the transit network that we provide on a daily basis. From a safety perspective, I think it's important to notice that we are now at an 83% completion rate in closing out the NTSB recommendations that we're working through. We closed out an additional 14 in fiscal 2014, leaving 5 remaining, and those really relate to long-term projects like the replacement and phasing out of the 1,000 series vehicles. We completed emergency evacuation response plans for 25 Metro Rail stations. I should note that we were the first rail transit company in the nation to implement a close call program to incentivize a closed safety information loop. And we did that voluntarily with the coordination of Local 69 and the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. And we also launched an agency-wide fatigue management program that received accolades from APTA that helps us make sure that we are providing the safest operators in the network at all points in time. And that goes without going into the significant detail about the mezzanine lighting upgrades as well as other aspects of our safety culture that we've made significant strides on. From a customer care perspective, we know that the last time this board met in full, you heard about the public participation plan, which is now adopted, as well as earlier in the day, aspects of the customer care initiative. Behind the scenes, we also launched a host of other programs, including a callback initiative where a customer that might call in with a question or complaint about Metro, we track those customers and call back a significant number of them to make sure that those questions and or complaints, in fact, move towards resolution. We've got 73% of our bus operators now having completed the We Care training. We now have 70% of the recommended detectable tile, the bumpy tile in the stations, completed. We've got LED signs in our rail station to provide timely and accurate and clear and easy to read information for our customers so that they are better informed about using the network both in times of full operation as well as in times of an incident. We continue to use our mystery shoppers so that we get real-time information about where we are excelling and where we have room for improvement. And we have more than 300 locations now identified for real-time next bus signage. And that Now, this list could go on and on and on, which I've detailed for you in the full report. With respect to connecting communities, I think we all can pat ourselves on the back for the significant amount of work that had to go into preparing the agency to absorb and operate the Silver Line. And to date, that project is performing above expectations. I think there are the history of transportation projects broadly is one of slow ramp up, and we should all be proud that this project is achieving ridership that is on its way to accomplishing the projected ridership, and that can't always be said for major capital projects nationwide or in this region. So, not only have the results to date been exceptionally strong on the Silver Line, but the results to date of the region's first BRT network have also been exceptionally strong. That opened up Phase 1 service on August 24th, and we're looking at an average of 7,700 riders per week. We've also implemented a coordinated approach to paratransit service and initiated a regional accessibility initiative to provide a greater strategic perspective on how we deliver specialized transportation services in this region. And I think that it goes without saying that we're all very happy to see not only state of good repair funding, but also state of good operations funding contained within the region's long-range plan. It is important to note that some of these aspects of improving regional mobility and connecting communities commenced with the much-heralded work on the Priority Corridor Network before the adoption momentum, but which is carried through in the funding request momentum. And by 2014, we had completed work we completed all the studies that we said we were going to complete in 2008. We had implemented, if not completed, work on 16 of the 24 lines that were called out in the Priority Corridor Network. We'd added 7 million riders to those bus lines and seeing on-time performance and ridership increase in almost every case where we've implemented service improvements on the PCN. So with respect to improving regional mobility and connecting communities, much to celebrate. And certainly, we're also, right now, even in this session, beginning to implement the after effects of a major achievement, which is the securing of a down payment of $75 million from the governors and the mayor for the first capital investments for Metro 2025. So this allows us to begin to work on the infrastructure necessary to prepare the system to run our 8-car trains. Behind the scenes also, we have implemented the beginnings of an asset management plan, as well as implemented life cycle contract management programs and practices that allow us to be better stewards of the assets that we operate, as well as to plan for the future in a way that a business can and should prepare for the future. We're also able to execute a collective bargaining agreement with Local 2, which accomplished one of our priority actions, which was to establish and secure affordable collective bargaining agreements, and also identifying ways that we can save the authority money while achieving environmental goals. We launched a sustainability initiative and a sustainability lab to experiment with ways to green the authority from the inside and out, while recognizing bottom-line savings. I think that some of you are aware that some of those investments are actually going in the ground right now. Those chiller upgrades that on average will save about $15,000 per station are being installed today in pilot phase, and we hope to be able to monitor them and then roll them out at the system-wide level as soon as the metricing of those stations have been complete. So at a high level, I hope that that provides some of the highlights from the report which we issued to you earlier this year, and gives us detail about the fact that we at Metro are doing our part. All of these accomplishments, plus the many other accomplishments listed in that report, are critical not just for Metro, but they're also critical for the region's future. And the reason is that the region's economic success truly is riding on Metro. What we see, and this is a blank map right now, but the best research that we have suggests that the entire region is growing around what George Washington University calls walk-ups, walkable urban places. And we've seen this being revealed not only through initiatives that are being sponsored by our partner jurisdictions, but also within our planning leadership. And if we go through bit by bit, we see six different distinct types, from existing downtowns that are revitalizing, to suburban town centers, to strip suburban commercial redevelopment, to former greenfields that are being densified at rapid rates. And if we take a look at places like Tysons Corner in Fairfax County, we've got $18 billion of property under development today. And we're really just getting started. So the impacts of the Silver Line upon the economic future of our jurisdiction's partners is really only getting started. In Montgomery County, they're projecting that 30% of the new households between 2010 and 2030 will be within a half mile of Metro. Prince George's County is now targeting 15% of its future household growth to be within a transit-oriented development district. So these will generate ridership on the system, and you can see when we overlay the Metro Rail system exclusively upon where this region is growing, the region's growth is inextricably tied to the success of the Metro system. This is the planning forecast. When we take a look at the actual forecast and ask real estate professionals, well, what's in the pipeline? How important is this? We found in October of 2013 that development professionals are forecasting 85% of the commercial development pipeline was not within one half a mile, but within one quarter mile of a Metro Rail station. As of today, we went back to real estate professionals and asked them, what's the pipeline looking like now? And let's look a little bit further afield than just a quarter mile. And as it turns out, there's roughly 100 million square feet of development in the pipeline, means under construction or in the pipeline, within a half mile of Metro. For these investments to actually pan out and to create the type of value that the jurisdictions are hoping that they will create, we rely on a successfully and adequately functioning Metro system, and we require the capacity that's promised by initiatives that are contained within Momentum and Metro 2025. If the region's growing around Metro, it's going to depend on a system that can carry the load, and that is among the many reasons why Metro 2025 is so critically important. What it delivers for us is it delivers not only the train capacity to carry forward and make sure that that 100 million square feet of development that's in the pipeline, plus the additional growth that we showed you in the previous slide, can function the way we all anticipate it to be functioning, and the jurisdictions can recognize, by the way, the property tax revenue that they're hoping they can recognize, but also the promise of making sure that the more than 100,000 jobs that will not be in this region but for the congestion mitigation that Metro 2025 provides, the 100,000 trips we want to take off of the arterials and put them onto the Metro bus network as a result of a successful PCN, so that we can combat that crippling congestion, which is not only costing us dollars but also harming our air quality, and making sure that our customers have the most sophisticated information network and ability to navigate the region and in a way that's intuitive to plan, pay, and ride, is part of the nation's capital transportation system. We know we've, as of today, have over 60 businesses that have signed up online, over 10,000 individuals, organizations left and right that have supported Metro 2025. And at this point in time, I think it's important for this board and the region to recognize that a key milestone will be making sure that we can execute the remaining options on the 7,000 series rail cars so that we can, in fact, implement full A-car train operations in time to keep up with the region's growth. That deadline is approaching, and if we are not able to meet the funding obligations that are part of that deadline, that initiative gets kicked down the road by at least 5 years. And so with that, the next steps are, of course, to make sure that we complete the updated capital funding agreement, ensuring that there's enough dollars in there to pay for the additional 220 rail cars necessary to run A-car train operation, adopt Connect Greater Washington, which will be forthcoming next year and which is the blueprint for all transit in the region that we know Metro's been completing, and then, of course, to bring back to this board for update and adoption, updated strategic plan in calendar 2017. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board.
Thank you for the presentations. Are there any questions for staff? Mr. Belger.
Thanks for the presentation. Very helpful. The priority bus corridors, you said about three-quarters of them are operational?
There are physical, there are capital improvements and or running way improvements and or fleet and or service improvements on 16 of the 24 corridors that have been identified originally. All of the studies that we promised to do back in 2008 when the proposal was brought to the board have been completed as of now.
Okay, let me follow on question. So we've used up all the Tiger money? It's been spent?
I'll defer to Mr. Rico on that, but the answer
good.
Is yes.
Are obligated or what's spent or obligated? Jim.
We have about two-thirds of the Tiger grant that has been committed to specific task order projects mm-hmm. or completed. We're working on final design to complete the rest, and all of it will be completed by the end date of approximately June 2016.
So what's the remaining priority corridors of the 16 are done, and which ones are left to do?
Well, just to clarify, none of the corridors are fully complete. As Sean was indicating, there is investment in 16 of the 24. We took to public hearing, I think it was three of the remaining priority corridor services. There is a lot of additional information about what each corridor needs, but we've made important strides and seen almost 7 million additional annual riders on those corridors.
Could you tell us of the 16, which ones are in the District of Columbia and which ones are not in the 16?
Oh, yes, I can. We provide that information. Wisconsin 16th, 14th, Georgia, H Street, North Capitol, Pennsylvania Avenue, Martin Luther King.
Which ones are 100% operational?
Well, they're all operating every day, all week. So there is service, but there are deficiencies where we're not meeting standard, where we have loads. We recently, this year, invested in the Pennsylvania Avenue and Wisconsin Avenue lines and are seeing the benefit in terms of improved on-time performance, improved convenience, better reliability, and hopefully more riders.
Okay, Jim, last question. Which ones of those corridors have the preemptive signal?
That has not been implemented yet. Okay. That's final design has been completed. We're getting ready for the factory acceptance testing, and then we'll begin deploying in cooperation with District Department of Transportation.
When do you think we're going to see the preemptive signal on the buses with the software?
Well, there's actually a couple of projects. One, DDOT's doing an optimization of all the traffic signals downtown, which will help greatly move traffic. Right. And then secondly, the TSP will begin to see deployment sometime next year. Various corridors will be spread throughout the year.
Okay, keep us posted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belger. Are there any other questions or comments, staff? Thank you again for the excellent presentation. Again, we made significant progress with our 1 year with momentum. We still have significant work ahead of us, including the capital funding agreement, as well as moving to an 8-car trade scenario. So I think we have a lot of important work ahead of this committee, as well as the board of the agency as a whole. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the board.
Next up is a discussion of our rail ridership. We have Mr. Schofield here to present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This ridership discussion is an important part of the FY 2016 budget development process. We'll be back here in November for an additional discussion prior to the general manager's actual proposal of the FY 16 budget in December. So to put it simply, the region's economy is in a transition, and that transition poses a challenge for Metro. This challenge will be, we will have to deal with this challenge as a part of the FY 16 budget. But we believe, as you just heard in Shyam's presentation, that the future for the region and for Metro Rail remains strong. So this presentation will touch on both sides of that. So Metro Rail and the region's economy are tightly linked and mutually beneficial. The region had a very strong economic run from the mid-1990s up through the late 2000s, and Metro Rail both helped to cause that run and was also the beneficiary of it. Annual ridership increased 50% during that period, from 150 million trips to almost 225 million trips, which is an average growth rate of over 3% per year. This growth was primarily the result of two different trends. The first was the revitalization of the urban core, not just in places like the District, which was stimulated in part by the opening of the Green Line, but also in places like Bethesda, Silver Spring, and the Roslyn-Ballston corridor. The second trend was the post-9/11 growth in federal employment. Together, the revitalization and the added employment allowed Metro Rail to grow the original core market of long-distance, downtown-focused commuting trips, while at the same time adding ridership in urban-focused, shorter trips, including ridership in the off-peak. So things were going very well for a long time. But then came the financial crisis and the recession. When the recession first hit, the Washington economy did relatively well, and Metro Rail also did well compared to many other transit agencies, which experienced substantial ridership losses. So as this chart, which is from the Center for Regional Analysis at George Mason, shows, compared to other top employment regions in the country, Washington had the greatest net job growth in the country between 2009 and 2010. But since 2011, the Washington region has been hit by substantial changes to federal employment. These changes have included sequestration, the retirement and non-replacement of older federal employees, and the winding down of military efforts. Direct federal employment peaked at the end of 2010 and has declined since then. Federal contractor employment is a little bit harder to track, but overall professional and business services employment peaked at the beginning of 2013 and has also declined since then, as have jobs in the information sector. So, as seen in this chart, which is also put together by George Mason, the gross regional product, which is like the GNP at the national level, but just for the region, actually declined in the Washington metro area from 2012 to 2013. Washington was the only metro area of the top 15 regions in the country to show a decline last year. The economic impact can be seen across the transportation network, not just for Metro Rail. Congestion on the region's roads also peaked in 2010 and has not yet recovered, as measured by the travel time index, which is the ratio of congested travel time to regular free flow travel time. In particular, congestion on the interstates in the region continues to decline into 2014. Some of this, of course, is likely due to changes in commuting patterns, which we will discuss shortly, but the impact of the economy is clearly apparent. So to reiterate, the Washington region is in a transition. The federal government is not going away, but most observers don't see it as a source of future growth. So what does the future hold? Well, predictions are hard, especially about the future, but most medium and long-term forecasts indicate that the region will remain a desirable place to live and work. The estimates that we've received for 2025 from Moody's show total federal employment continuing to slightly decline, but have that be much outweighed by growth of 15 to 20% in sectors such as professional services, health, state and local government, and education. During that same period, we expect the overall population growth by 2025 to be approximately 13%. And by 2040, using the estimates that are embedded in TPB's long-range plan, we expect to see total employment grow by 35% and total population to grow by 25%. As TPB's plan makes clear, these new arrivals will require new transportation infrastructure. So, the macroeconomic changes are driving the overall trends, but there are a number of other factors that are having an impact, both positive and negative. And so I want to focus on three different challenges: changes in commuting patterns, growth in modes besides rail, and pricing, and then also on three different opportunities: reduced track work, marketing, and transit-oriented development. These will all be playing out in fiscal 16 and beyond. It can be difficult to put specific numbers on some of these, but we're continuing to analyze the data in order to come to our final projections for FY16. Changing commute patterns, particularly in the form of telework and alternative work schedules, is something that we continue to investigate here at Metro. We're currently working through a massive set of longitudinal data, looking at ridership patterns that are linked to individual smart trip IDs in order to try to draw some stronger conclusions about whether people's frequency of travel is changing. We're not done with that yet, but we do have information from surveys and from broader data sources that we can look at. The latest surveys from OPM show that more than 10% of federal employees now telecommute at least once a week. Whew. But only 3%, that's right, but only 3% of those employees are spending a majority of their work days away from the office. However, that statistic does cover a number of federal employees who don't live within the Washington region, and it is difficult to get data on non-federal workers. They don't have as comprehensive a survey. So far, these results are only suggestive. However, the ridership data that was recently requested by the JCC, looking at ridership on Metro Rail by the half hour, also highlighted some interesting trends. We continue to see a decline in travel on Fridays relative to the midweek travel, which is a consistent result with occasional telework and AWS-type scheduling. But most interesting to me was that even during a decline in the overall ridership on rail, we did still see ridership in the peak of the peak from 7:30 to 9 o'clock in the morning hold constant. And I think that's important to keep in mind, since the capacity investments that we're going to be looking at have to be done with that peak of the peak in mind. Another challenge for Metro Rail is the continued growth in bike and bus. Now, if you're wearing a regional transportation planning hat, this is good news. People have more options for their trips, and they're taking advantage of those options. And for bus in particular, this is due to the actions of the people in this room. It has required a consistent effort by staff and a consistent support from the board, but Metro Bus in 2014, I think customers view it as an excellent value. The fleet is attractive and reliable. The service is frequent and convenient, and it has a relatively low fare. Increasingly, we see choice riders choosing bus, and in certain corridors, like 16th Street, we have trouble getting enough buses through to carry them all. But if you're in the budget office, like me, and you're facing what is the lower fare box recovery ratio that is associated with bus, it does pose a challenge. The other one is bicycle commuting. As you may have heard earlier, bicycle commuting in the district has doubled in mode share from approximately 2% to 4%, just over a very short period, 4 or 5 years, propelled by factors such as more bike lanes in the city and also the success of Capital Bike Share. And there was a recent study which did a survey of Capital Bike Share users, which confirmed what we had suspected. If you're talking about the urban periphery, transit and bike share are complements to each other. They allow for trips to be made through a combination of transit and bike that you wouldn't be able to do with just one or the other. But in the urban core, bike share can be a substitute for transit. For shorter trips, especially in the off-peak, it can be easier and cheaper just to grab a bike from the corner than to go down into the rail station and pay a fare and wait for the train. So again, from a regional transportation planning perspective, this is a positive outcome. But we need to keep an eye on it, and we also need to make sure that we are encouraging those trips where the bike share and the transit can complement each other. Finally, the third challenge is pricing. One of the bigger challenges we have faced recently is the reduction in the federal transit subsidy. In the past, when the transit benefit covered all or most of the longer regular commutes, we were able to raise fares without risking too much ridership loss. But now, if you are a park and ride customer at Vienna or Shady Grove, you're looking at $16 a day. If you're a five-day-a-week commuter, the $130 monthly transit benefit is not going to cover that whole bill. It is relatively easy, even around here, to find early bird parking for that sort of a price, and to say nothing of the fact that the federal parking benefit remains at the much higher level of $245 a month. Of course, there's a trade-off for anyone who's looking at making that shift. Driving means more gas, more wear and tear on your car, more time spent navigating traffic, but we do think that at the margin, some people are going to make that shift. And as we have discussed previously in earlier discussions, the FY13 fare increase, which was larger in the off-peak, approximately 25%, did also have a negative impact on off-peak and discretionary riders. So now let's shift to the opportunities. As we have reported to you recently, we have reduced the intensity of our weekend track closures, and customers have noticed and they have responded, and weekend ridership has increased in recent months, and we expect this trend to continue. This also points to a broader issue of customer satisfaction. Rail customer satisfaction is influenced by a number of different factors, including reliability, comfort, security, and frequency. One area where we anticipate seeing improved customer response in the near term is comfort. As we begin reintroducing the automatic train operations, and as we begin phasing in the new 7000 series and phasing out the older 1000 series cars, we hope to see that improved customer satisfaction translate ultimately to more ridership. Our customer service and our marketing groups are also working hard to encourage additional ridership, particularly in the off-peak. This includes the rollout of the new convention pass, which was approved by the board as a part of the FY2015 budget, a partnership with the Washington West Film Festival to provide discounts for travelers who use the metro to reach the festival, discounts at Tyson's Corner during the holiday shopping season, we're calling those Silver Saturdays, and then a series of job fairs, which are actually concluding today, put on by the Tyson's Partnership, one at each of the four Silver Line stations in Tyson's. And then finally, and you've already heard Sean talk a lot about this, there's development around the Metrorail stations, which is the most critical long-term opportunity. Even with the overall decline in total ridership over the past couple of years, we have seen noticeable ridership increases at those stations where development has popped. This was true a decade ago at places like Clarendon, and it's true now for NOMA and for Navy Yard and for Dunloring and for a number of other key locations. And that development is not close to saturated. As Sean's presentation showed you, there's over 100 million square feet of development within the pipeline right around our stations. We believe that is going to be the future for Metrorail. So to recap, and then I'll jump quickly into the actions that we're taking here in the short term. Again, a transition towards less reliance for the region on both direct and indirect federal employment is going to be challenging for the region and for Metrorail in the near term. But our long-range investment planning is based on a belief that we think is supported by reasonable forecasts that the region will continue to be an attractive place for people to live and to work. And more specifically, from an operating perspective, we need to encourage more trip making at all times of the day and for people making all different kinds of trips. Whether we do that through marketing or through pricing or through something else, that's something that on the operating side, that's something that we have to focus on. But from a capacity investment perspective, we really do need to focus on that midweek rush hour peak period. And the demand in that period has stayed steady, you know, despite the recent challenges that we've had, and we do believe that that will pick up again as the region's economy strengthens. So the immediate task that we face as far as the budget is to continue to refine our ridership and revenue proposals leading into the December budget proposal. Our current guidance is that overall revenues will be flat to down a little bit, primarily due to lack of growth in rail, but balanced out a little bit by continuing positive performance for bus. We are continuing to push for the transit benefit to return to parity with the parking benefit. Not that that would be a panacea, but that it would help to level the playing field. As we mentioned, we're going to continue to pursue marketing opportunities to encourage ridership growth in the off-peak. And then finally, while it's not going to happen as a part of the FY16 budget because we're not planning for a fare increase this time, we do need, I think, to begin thinking about fares for FY17. And we look forward to doing that with input from the JCC and also from the Riders Advisory Council. As you know, we have already pledged to assist them in the project that they're undertaking to look at some ideas for fare simplification. And so with that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the excellent presentation, Mr. Schofield. Are there any questions for staff? Mr. Nichols.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate it. And you always raise as many questions as you do answers, and that's a good thing. One area that, if you can help me, or perhaps Shyam, or maybe it's in the field of play or out, we do our Title VI analysis in terms of understanding the disparate impact that may or may not happen to different segments of the population that may be impacted by ridership. We satisfy ourselves in that regard. We have, in the context of the shift in the regional economy, it's a continuing trend. We don't know where it's going, but shifting from federal type work to our shifting to telecommuting, all of those kinds of things that are a rider class that is shifting how we operate. And we are trending toward leisure activities and all of those kinds of things that bring a different type of ridership pattern and those kinds of things. The piece that is a continuing struggle for me to get is that those activities depend upon a working class that is losing its opportunity to sustain living in the environment here. Housing costs go up, transportation costs go up, and yet the working classification that is necessary to support the kinds of activities that we're describing is a wage earner that is having a more and more difficult time sustaining a lifestyle here in the marketplace. So part of I look forward and I wonder if we lose the people who are going to sustain the economic engine of future, that in a different way begins to undercut our ability to grow the economy and also to sustain and build the ridership that's going to make that new economy work, because that class of worker that has to support the leisure activities and things like that simply won't be here. And that's not the person who is telecommuting or the person who comes in for a vacation or a business trip. It's the person who works 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or whatever that is and simply is being priced out of the marketplace. It's not necessarily our problem to solve by ourselves, but I worry about it in terms of how we calculate our long-term ridership and our own planning and investment. And you might be able to say to me, that's not going to be a problem, but I need to understand that or whether it's something I shouldn't be worried about as we look at our ridership trends and how we buy infrastructure.
You've raised a number of challenging questions. I do think I think that the potential is there, and please tell me if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly. I think the attractiveness of real estate around our rail stations has certainly had the impact of raising housing prices in those particular areas, and so that the sort of middle to lower wage earner, like you were talking about, is being pushed into parts of the region that really don't have as much access to rail. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Not only do they not have access to rail, but the housing costs, even beyond transit-oriented development sites, are rapidly moving beyond the affordable index, and that wage earner is changing how they have to live. They're moving further out. They're changing their living conditions, and it's making a very difficult, and it's a different discussion, not necessarily directly related to what we're talking about, but it is related in terms of how that segment of the working community supports the industry on which we base our ridership projections. That's my concern about it. I'm not asking you to take on a research project around affordable housing and affordability of the region, but I think it does influence the sustainability of our economy and how we guide ourselves on understanding where our infrastructure has to be invested.
I think you're right, and I don't think I have a definitive answer to
if
that.
You had
right
one,
now.
It's a concern, a deep concern that
sure.
I have.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Goldman.
Thank you. Your reports are always very informative and very thought-provoking, and as a board, we sort of need to be able to know what the future is going to look like, even though we can't predict it, as you point out. I just had one informational question. Earlier in your presentation, you referred to a Moody's forecast, page 6 or slide 6, in which the percentages there are very encouraging, 25% growth, profession, et cetera. Do you recall what the base period is that those percentage growths are predicted from?
I was calculating that as 2025 versus 2013. So
the base would be 2013?
Yes, sir.
Is this a document that's not too big that you could contribute to it?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mrs. Hines and Mrs. Hudgens.
I just want to return briefly to Alvin's question, which I wanted to say welcome to my world. This is what I do in my other job. Yeah. But it occurred to me as you were speaking that there is there's a possible way for us to think about the cost of transportation and the cost of housing together and begin to put that into a new lens potentially for the region. In Region Forward, we talk about housing plus transportation costs staying between 40 and 45% of income. And it just occurs to me as we're thinking about potential, increases and looking at all of this, that if WMATA started doing that comparison more explicitly when we're considering raising fares, that might in fact help move the conversation in the region. And so I would encourage us to think about, is there a way that we can begin to show that both on the rail side, with rail and with bus, because our riders do have a choice. The other thing I wanted just to ask about, in your last slide, you talked about next steps, and one of them really is this advocacy around getting the transit benefit back. And my jurisdiction, perhaps most others, this is the time of the year when we are putting together our legislative packages, not only for our state level stuff, but for any federal work we might do. And I just wonder whether we might want to think as a board about sending a letter to all of the jurisdictions in our area saying, if you have a federal package, and this would be something that you could advocate for that actually would help ensure the ongoing viability of our organization and our service for your folks, because it really is pretty much straight up money that comes to Metro or to our local bus services one way or another. I don't know if we have anything else like that that regionally we might want to encourage people to put on their radar screen, but again, just an opportunity for us to act more as convener and provider of information and to make this a very explicit connection to folks who pay the subsidy, basically.
Thank you. Mrs. Hutchins.
I will be a little bit repetitive because I think, as Mr. Nichols was speaking, beyond what Ms. Hines has said, I think it is a point that we have had this discussion before. We talked about whether or not we should have a policy or whether a policy lies with us at our regional jurisdictions. But I think the point that we should try and balance in the discussion is that while we want to drive that economy in our jurisdictions, we do worry about what happens in throughout the region on the other end. For example, the Largo Fair is a max fair to Reston. And that's there's a job center there and there's a housing center here. How do you bring that together and what happens when you balance those pieces? But I do think that advancing the transit benefit, but the larger picture is how are those communities developed comprehensively, and that includes the transit and affordable housing. So I think when we're talking about our planning and development piece, that's where we can have the most influence if we want to think of it as a WMATA role. Otherwise, you're right, it's when you go home and it's when I go home, that we have to be stronger advocates and do a lot more magic on affordable housing in these transit-oriented properties to make that Trulliger number that they talk about of housing and transportation work for us, because we will continue to see the disparities that spread across the region.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I think it's an important point, and it's a difficult one to wrestle with from a land development standpoint. I actually strongly believe that the real estate, the development, the planning decisions are local land use decisions, whether it's a county, a city, a state. Those are decisions that we're a tool in the process, but as an organization, we don't make them. On the other side of the fence, I think we're obligated to bring to light the kinds of impacts and influences that result from the transportation and infrastructure decisions that we make, and clearly it's intertwined. And we have to dance that dance elegantly, but it's important, critically important. Thank you.
Mr. Downs and Mr. Bulger.
There is a mechanism for mapping the gains that are made by location around the real estate and potentially partially offsets the well-known phenomena that the closer you get to a transportation hub, the more expensive the housing gets. A not-for-profit in Chicago, the Center for Neighborhood Technology, developed a pretty well-acknowledged and even a tool that is, in effect, a mortgage that is balanced with a credit about location efficiency. They use that in Chicago to map the areas where location efficiency generates, in effect, a mortgage bonus for people about housing. We've never in this region, it's interesting that a number of major banks have agreed that location-efficient mortgages are a legitimate framework for making housing mortgages available. The power is in the mapping. And this, I suggest it's worth the authority, looking at the applicability of that mapping tool as part of our connecting communities and our impact on the development of communities, looking at that as a tool to help this region understand that there are housing benefits that are not the negative kind of value creation that drives up the cost of housing around Metro, but there are options and show where those options might be viable for this region. It's already there. It's an existing tool. We ought to take advantage of it.
Mr. Bulger.
Yeah, I think what Tom's talking about is about 5 years old. Didn't Scott do this about 7 or 8 years ago in Chicago? Anyway, yeah, it's a really great tool, Center for Neighborhood Technology. I just want to bring something to the board's attention, the staff attention. The District of Columbia has passed an ordinance, which goes into effect January 1, 2016. It says that in any employer that has more than 20 employees must offer the transit benefit. Similarly, New York City passed a similar ordinance this week. It's on the way to the mayor. It's going to get signed. So there's a little bump there that if we could ever market this thing better, we could probably do something on that. Secondly, I want to bring your attention for the umpteenth time. Parking benefits set currently at $250 a month. It's going to go to $255 January 1, our guess. So you need to change page. I don't know what page that was on. It's in the, it's in the narrative to correct this record. And finally, we're going to give it a shot in lame duck to get this thing fixed. We just got a Joint Tax Committee score from the Joint Tax Committee that says that for the first time in the history of I've ever worked on this thing, we finally got a methodology where they took the we asked the Joint Tax Committee to take the parking benefit down to parity with transit, and the magic number is $235 a month. The House bill that we've been working on is $220 right now. So we've got a little wiggle room, and we're going to try to make this happen in the lame duck. If we get lucky, we might get parity.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for staff? If not, thank you again, Mr. Schofield, for the presentation. I understand you'll be back next month with a review of the FY 2016 budget. Mr.
Adding a point to Mr. Bolger's comment, this does have a potential in the lame duck session. Any strength that any of the jurisdictions can bring to that as a priority would really be helpful.
Anybody
parking benefit.
Of the House or
right. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We'll move to the next item, which is the business plan update, and we have Mr. Sarles and Mr. True.
Good. Good afternoon. Thank you. I think we've come a long way in the last few years in just how we approach the budget. A few years ago, we had a budget, and yes, it is. A few years ago, yes, we had a budget, and then we had the general manager's execution plan. And in the last few years, we've evolved that, certainly with the board's support and guidance, we developed a strategic plan, and from that flows a business plan, a three-year business plan, which we return to every year to update it and extend it another year in the future, and that's what we're talking about a little bit today. And then the budget is based on that, so we've turned things around a little bit there. As Sean mentioned earlier, and I just want to give a few highlights to what we've accomplished under the business plan over the last couple of years. The focus is and remains on safety. 29 NTSB recommendations have been closed. I frankly think we'll be submitting for closure a couple more shortly. Close call program is the first launch for a major U.S. Rapid transit system. And we hope to expand on that. The fatigue risk management program, this summer we adopted hours of service and other policy actions with regard to rail and bus operators, maintenance personnel, and we're in the development of similar things for Metro Access and Metro Transit Police over the next few months. The escalator availability is up to 93%. We're buying fuel-efficient buses, and we've opened Silver Line Metroway, as we know. And we also have put in place a number of financial management reforms. And working along with the board, we're intensely focused on reforming our financial management and have taken numerous steps over the summer and early fall. Specifically in response to the FTA's financial management oversight review, which Dennis will go into much more detail later on, we've submitted documentation for 62 of the 65 total correction action plans. Although two of those caps were submitted within the deadlines, we're working with the FTA on the revised deadlines for the remaining two. We've hired Dennis as our new CFO with more than 12 years' experience in the transit industry. He's bringing new leadership to the financial team. We've created the first ever grants policy, revised and strengthened the procurement policy. We've trained nearly 300 employees on new grants policy and nearly 500 on procurement. Every Metro employee involved in procurement and grants management will receive training. But at the same time, we remain focused on continuing to press forward to deliver on the board's four strategic goals, which I'd just like to restate. Build, maintain a premier safety culture and system. Meet or exceed customer expectations by consistently delivering quality service. Improve regional mobility and connect communities. Ensure financial stability, invest in our people and assets. As you heard from Sham, each department develops and implements this plan, and all of their work plans are focused on actions that deliver on our shared objectives and deliver on a strategic plan. And as such, this plan is owned by the whole organization, with the executive team providing leadership, which is why I've asked Rob Troop, our DGMO, for DGMO to update you on the 2015-17 business plan, since this group will be leading it even after I'm gone.
Thank you, Mr. Sorrells, and good afternoon. Before I get into the details of the business plan, I'd like to explain how I and the entire executive team are approaching Metro's business plan. I want to tell you, 37 years ago, and in fact, 37 years ago this very month, I started my transportation career as a track laborer for Amtrak in Perryville, Maryland. I was rolling out 39-foot stringers of rail, and we were replacing them with quarter-mile sections of continuous routed rail. And for people who don't know railroad jargons, that means that I was literally pounding spikes into ties. I lived in camp cars and rail yards. I ate breakfast made by a cook who was nicknamed Cookie. And I traveled up and down the Northeast Corridor. In fact, the first night that I ever spent in Washington, D.C. was in Ivy City Yard, which is next to our NoMo station. And, you know, you would be hard-pressed to find a job that was further away from the customer than that one was. But this is where I first learned that what I did affected customer service. Our superintendent, Tony Campani, was an old-school railroader who walked with that fast sort of awkward gait that you get from trying to match your stride with the tie spacing. Well, anyway, we constantly made our production schedule because he would walk the entire length of the rail gang, the full half mile, about five times each day. And the message was always the same. We're stealing time from the passengers, boys. Let's get it done so they can get their track back. We're stealing time. You know, it wasn't our track or his track or even Amtrak's track. It was the passengers' track. And so it is with this business plan. Every action that we undertake, every initiative we make has to improve the customer's experience on Metro. Some they will see, like shiny new rail cars and shiny new buses, and you know, some they won't, like shiny new rail or shiny new procurement processes. But each action in the plan directly benefits the customer. The executive team recently went through a risk management analysis, and those strategies became part of the business plan process. Clearly, risk strategies benefit our passengers by ensuring that the authority is responsible and collaborative in evaluating hazards to our mission and planning ahead to minimize potential impacts. Now, let me tell you how this plan organizes Metro's investments over the next 3 years to deliver improvements to our customers. Obviously, safety continues to be our number one priority, both for our customers and also for our employees. Initiatives like Close Call create an environment where all of our employees, regardless of the position they have in the company, are engaged in improving safety and reporting out hazards that may exist within the system. We continue to work on closing out NTSB recommendations, notably the replacement of the 1000 series cars with 7Ks that have state-of-the-art crash energy management crumple zones. Implementation of wayside worker warning will be prioritized in the coming years, which will provide another layer of protection for employees who are inspecting and maintaining the right-of-way. The business plan also lays the groundwork for safer and smoother rail travel with the full implementation of automated train operations by 2017. The plan protects passengers and employees by ensuring bus and rail operators have the rest they need to do their job safely. We are one of the first transit agencies in the nation to develop and implement a fatigue management program. We're also investing in our fare payment system of the future that gives riders more options to securely and efficiently pay for their Metro ride, more options. With nearly 100 new and rehabbed escalators and 50 elevators, the business plan will provide more reliable service and also reduce delays for customers who are getting into and out of our stations. Other station improvements will also continue. We've seen how brighter lighting is helping people with disabilities to get around our stations, so the business plan continues investing to make our stations easier to navigate. The plan provides bus customers with more seats, newer buses, and increased service through the Better Bus Initiative. You'll recall this is the program that we started in 2012 to increase service on routes that serve roughly one-third of Metro bus riders. And our bus and Metro access teams are partnering with the jurisdictions to make bus stops more accessible for all of our riders. The business plan also invests in new facilities. We'll have two new modern Metro bus facilities, Cinderbed Road and Southern Avenue, to keep our buses serviced and running smoothly. And the Greenbelt test track will be finished so we can test the new 7K cars without disrupting regular service for our passengers. The business plan commits to the new customer care initiative that will transform Metro's culture into one that values customer satisfaction and ensures that we engage those customers in new ways and gather their input whenever a major change is being considered. This business plan continues the work to maintain our system into a state of good repair, with a major rehabilitation project planned for nearly 19 miles of rail line between National Airport and New Carrollton, which will improve the right-of-way in stations, much like what is currently underway on the Red Line. Finally, by the end of the calendar year 2017, the business plan provides more than 400 new 7,000 series rail cars. New rail cars are critical to our customers' daily experience, and I want to repeat that again, 400 new rail cars, almost half the fleet. And I want you to consider these facts for a minute. The 1000 series rail car, the oldest in our fleet, creates 1 minute of delay for passengers for every 5,000 miles traveled. That's 1 minute of delay for every 5,000 miles that 1000 travels. The newest cars, the 6000 series, go 22,000 miles before creating a single minute of delay. I have challenged our engineers and railcar maintenance personnel to deliver a 7,000 series railcar that will go three times farther than that, 70 to 80,000 miles before creating a single minute of delay to our customers, and I do believe that they will meet that challenge. And apart from the Metro Ford reliability work, there is no single investment that is more important to customer service than modernizing our bus, rail, and Metro access fleet. You know, some may look at recent ridership trends and question the need for eight-car trains, but we've seen ridership growth in recent years, and we do know that it will happen again. Just take the 2 years, like was said, from 27 to 29, when ridership grew by more than 7%, or 15 million riders. We need to be preparing now to accommodate that type of growth and ensure the region stays economically viable. That's why it's so critical that we have in place a new capital funding agreement by June 2015. Why? That's just 7 months from now, and that's the deadline when we must decide whether or not we can extend the contract with Kawasaki to purchase an additional 220 rail cars. If we do so, Metro will be able to accept 15 to 16 rail cars per month, which means putting 130 rail cars into revenue service by fiscal year 2020 and the remaining rail cars by fiscal year 2021. But if the money required for the rail car portion of this initiative is not secured in a CFA by June of 2015, this option will be lost. We cannot afford to wait. Delays in addressing the full funding needs of Metro 2025 plan and specifically making progress towards eight-car trains translates directly to less lost economic growth for the entire region. Earlier this year, Virginia, Maryland, and the district leaders showed their support for the Metro 2025 plan by providing an increased capital commitment of $75 million. This laid the groundwork for the larger commitment that's now needed to keep Metro moving on the right path. And we can see where this path is leading. Safety is improving. Reliability is improving. Service delivery is improving. And this business plan, and more importantly, its execution, ensures that our customers will continue to have a better experience when traveling on Metro. You know, we do this work to improve the system not because it's the easy thing to do, but because it's the right thing to do for our customers. The easy thing would be to run trains, not worry about the condition of the right-of-way, and not take single tracks or shutdowns. But it's not the right thing. The right thing is doing the hard work with an understanding and respect of the passenger's inconvenience. The right thing is being sure that the work is planned and planned well, that we are maximizing every single minute that we borrow from our passengers. We do this to provide a railroad that is safe, reliable, and also a viable transportation option. This business plan ensures that the next generation of Metro is already under construction. We're working hard building it now. We've come a long way in recent years, and while we're not yet the best ride in the nation, with continued funding of this plan, I know that we can be. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for staff regarding the business plan?
Mr. Acosta, I had to restrain myself from clapping.
Any other comments, questions? Mr. Downey.
When will we see a business plan with numbers, costs, capital investment, the things that will guide us into the budget? This sets forth where we want to be, but we also need the step of what actions and funding do we need to have to make it work. Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you again for the great presentation. We'll move on to the next topic, which is state of good repair. Mr. Bitar.
Good afternoon. During my last capital program presentation, the board requested an update on state of good repair. So that's what we're going to try to do for you today. Metro's capital program covers a large amount of infrastructure and rolling stock. We determine an asset to be in state of good repair if the asset operates within the design parameters and if it is within the expected life cycle. The asset life cycle might need to be adjusted periodically based on engineering reviews, condition assessments, testing, or data analysis. As an example, an escalator installed indoors will have a longer life cycle than an identical escalator exposed to the weather. The information I'm about to present was determined by the asset quantity divided by the life cycle years. Today, I will present updates for 8 individual projects: fasteners, cross ties, running rail joint elimination, running rail replacements, escalators, rail cars, metro access vehicles, and metro bus. Starting with fasteners, Metro's system has over 585,000 rail fasteners on the revenue track bed. As shown in the chart, track and structures made significant progress in past years to catch up with the backlog. The backlog was eliminated in fiscal year 14, and based on an 18-year life cycle, we project that to maintain a state of good repair, we need to replace about 30,000 fasteners a year from this point forward. Cross ties. Metro system has over 247,000 cross ties on the revenue track bed. Tracking structures, again, made significant progress in past years, but must continue to eliminate the backlog by fiscal year 17. To achieve this, DRST needs to replace 18,000 cross ties for the next 2 years, 18,000 a year for the next 2 years, to catch up with the backlog. With a life cycle of 18 years, DRST needs to replace 14,000 cross ties starting in fiscal year 17. So that's continuous work. Running rail joint elimination. I have been telling you that life cycle plays a role in state of good repair. In this instance, there is no life cycle for an open joint, okay? However, is not a bad condition. However, as we reduce the number of open joints in the system, we will see a big improvement in quality of ride. Our target is to weld more locations than the number of open joints created by the rail replacement program. Keep in mind that every time that we install a rail section, we create two more locations that will need to be welded at a later date. Back in fiscal year 2013, there were 819 welds completed. However, as we improved our rail replacement program, we created about 1,000. So that contributed to the backlog to grow a little bit. To address the situation, we added a second welding crew for fiscal year 14. Fortunately, we had the Union Station accident back in early fiscal year 14, and the program was halted for 3 months. After we restarted the program, we went back to only one crew instead of two, and that obviously contributed or affected our production capacity. Since then, the second piece of equipment has been returned to service for fiscal year 15. So now we're going back to two. And moving forward, TRST is targeting to complete 1,150 wells a year. Regarding the running rail replacement, Metro System has about 2.5 million linear feet of running rail. As shown in the chart, track structures made progress in past years to catch up with the backlog. The backlog was eliminated back in fiscal year 13, and based on a 37-year life cycle, we project that to maintain a state of good repair, we need to replace about 66,000 linear feet a year. 66,000. Moving to escalators. For escalators, we establish an average life cycle of 15 years. The current replacement and rehabilitation efforts help us to eliminate some of the backlog. However, as shown in the chart, fiscal year 16 is the last year for escalator rehabilitations. At that point in time, the only running contract will be the escalator replacements. Escalator replacements take longer than rehabilitations. And as a result, there is no improvement addressing the backlog. So you can see that it's constant after 16. The Office of Elevators and Escalators is working with procurement to put together a rehabilitation contract that will allow us to move forward on our state of good repair efforts. The state of good repair projections will be revised once a contractor has been selected and production capacity is determined. Moving to Metro rail cars, you have heard a little bit about the 7,000 series today. As you know, we have six different rail car series and a total of 1,098 active cars in the fleet. The 1,000s, shown in purple in that chart, are at the end of their life cycle. The chart shows how they will be phased out and replaced with 7,000 series rail cars. Keep in mind that the first 64 cars that will be commissioned are not replacing 1,000 series cars. These are for the Dulles extension. After the first 64 are commissioned, then we're going to start our replacement program. In addition, in 2018, the 4,000 series cars will also be replaced with 7,000s. This very important investment will help us maintain the fleet in a state of good repair. However, if I can draw your attention to the year 2020, you will notice a small backlog being created. That one is marked in blue. What that represents is the first 48 5,000 series cars that will be due for midlife overhaul. And the 2,000s and 3,000 series rail cars are not far behind. They are due for replacement starting in 2022. Regarding Metro Access vehicles, as you can see in the chart, Metro has invested in this fleet to bring the average age under 2.5 years. Now that we have achieved this goal, We need to continue the replacement program at a rate of 150 vehicles a year. And last but not least is the Metropolis fleet. Thanks to continued investment, it has been renewed. And today we have an average age under our state of good repair target of 7 years. Moving forward, a constant procurement cycle of about 100 buses a year is required to maintain the fleet within target. There are many aspects of the capital program that contribute to the system we have today. A lot of work has taken place on the track bed, in the stations, procuring new equipment to replace all equipment, or improving our IT infrastructure. All of it plays a role in our effort to improve the services Metro provides. But none of it would have been possible without the board's support and commitment to this program. A lot of work has taken place, but the system continues to age, and the demand on it continues to grow, accelerating equipment wear. Now that we're getting closer to a state of good repair in many categories, the necessary investment needs to be in place to maintain what has been gained and continue to improve in other areas. Thank you for your support. This concludes my presentation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there any questions for Mr. Matar?
Comment here.
I just had a curious question. What happens to the 1,000 series and then eventually the older? Where do they get scrapped, or do they?
They will be scrapped. We're working with the respective offices to decommission these vehicles. We need to put together a contract in place. Okay. We don't have details about the contract, but the contract needs to include who's responsible to picking up, cost associated with that, frequency of picking up, if we're going to be removing components out of it or not, stuff like that.
You think we could keep some of the older cars in spares, like bars?
No.
No. I'm not the 1,000. I'm talking about the 4 and the 5.
No. Yeah, no. No, the technologies that we're bringing with the 7,000 and the technologies that we're bringing with the, or will be bringing with the 8,000s are 21st century. We were holding back our fleet in design, trying to make the fleets compatible. So that's why the 7,000 is going to operate within itself. The 8,000 is envisioned to do the same thing. As far as I know, Joe could correct me if I'm wrong, but the only thing that should be compatible is just the mechanical coupler, just in case that we need to couple and tow one with another, but not operational compatibility at all.
Mr. Goldman, then Mr. Downey, then Mr. Nichols.
Mr. Bertard, in light of the cracked rail on the red line a couple weeks ago, your chart on running rail attracted my attention. On the running rail, I don't know if you can get that back up there, it's about the fourth or fifth chart in. There it is. So on the left-hand column, those represent, I think you said, linear feet of rail?
Yes.
So the total system has 2.4 million
plus,
linear
feet. Close to 2.5.
Yeah. And the stuff in the different color, in the red on the bottom, that's the 65,000 that are due for replacement each year.
Each year.
So for something like the red line, which is, I guess, has some of the oldest rails in the system. Mm-hmm. At this stage, what percent of the rails on the red line have been replaced? Do we know that number?
We sure did. I don't have the number right now, but we can easily provide that. We're using, now with the addition of the TGB, the track geometry vehicle, we're doing runs 4 times a year, and that has helped us a lot to determine the condition of the rails. So we're keeping track of all of that. I don't know exactly the percentage replacement, but we can certainly put something together.
Okay, because I guess we'll hear more about this in the safety
committee. We've asked for a report on this at the safety committee, and I think it'll be very enlightening.
But is the maintenance goal here to replace all of the rails on something like the red line, which is, I guess, 40 years old
on
at some point?
Yeah, on a 37-year cycle, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so do you have a sense of where we are in the cycle to replace those rails? Is this something we'll complete by 2017, 2018, or is this even further afield?
All of it is considered at this point in time to be within state of good repair. The backlog that was created was eliminated back in 13. Mm-hmm. That's where we have no backlog at all. So at this point in time, we're just entering a regular maintenance cycle and replacement cycle. So to answer your question, everything is within the design specs.
Okay. So since you don't have any red, any of the 65 in FY20, is it fair to conclude from that all of the rail that need to be replaced will be replaced by then?
No, actually, now that you pointed out, that is actually a mistake on the graph, because if you see the graph is shorter. So for whatever reason, the red block is missing over there. But no, the red block needs to continue over there forever.
Okay. All
right. So thank you for pointing that out. I didn't notice that until now.
Thank you. That's all I have for now.
Thank you.
Mr. Downing?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the report. And this is something we really have been looking for some time, in terms of not just how are we doing at catching up, but do we have the vision of where we need to go to keep up with that process. And as Shyam said earlier in his presentation, this has been endorsed by the region as a top priority need, that what's required to keep the system in a state of good repair is, in fact, the priority that they will agree to. But if we can't explain how we're doing it and what they will receive, they might back away from that. But right now, I think it's coming together at just the right time. Thank you.
Mr. Nichols?
Thank you. Thank you for that report. That was pretty impressive. You have, I could tell that the slides were a prop. You could have done that report without the slides. I can see that. Can see your enthusiasm and how invested you are in it. Here's what, it's a ton of data, and it really evidences a strong system of accountability in terms of understanding the nature of what we've got on our hands and what it takes. Can you talk a little bit about what the mechanism is, what your system of controls, and what kind of a robust environment you have for knowing when and why and how, and how do you know that 40,000 need to be changed in a 12-month period of time of light bulbs or whatever it is? Talk a little bit about the management controls in place to ensure that we are doing it on a timely basis. We know where the problem is going to exist or where it is, and we're going to fix it. What's the mechanism that we have in place to ensure that that's happening?
Right now what we have is each office, and I presented a lot of information for tracking structures in particular. They're keeping track of the condition of the track bed, the running rails, the joint eliminations, the fasteners, and the cross ties. And they keep a database. They're keeping a database of how many they have and how many they're replacing and what areas they have been working on in recent history. While we cannot determine every single fastener and every single tie as an asset and keep track of it, or every single lineal feet of rail as an asset, they are keeping track of segments of the railroad. So they're going and look at the system, and they're mapping the work that needs to be done based on historical data. Some of the rail that we're replacing is 40 years old, so there's not a lot of data from back there. Now, to help that, the track geometry vehicle that we're sending out is producing reports and is identifying areas of concern that immediately are reviewed by engineering and then passed along to the maintenance group. And that helps them prioritize the areas that they need to move next. And actually, sometimes the data shows that immediate action is required. So that will remove, obviously, to the front of the schedule. And that is sort of kind of the mechanics that they have on that regard. In regard to the other assets, like buses and rail cars and everything, the engineering groups are keeping track of that information, how old the asset is. They periodically go and review the availability of the equipment to prioritize replacements. As I tried to explain, and probably I could have done a better job explaining what's with the escalator, two identical escalators, we need to go back and take a look at it, and we do that annually or biannually, depending on the asset, and do assessments, condition assessments. Depending on that review, you might need to move the asset ahead of the schedule, or you might be able to consider pushing it back.
So, and not to get too far into the weeds, mm-hmm. just one final question. Do you have a dedicated business unit within your group that has fixed responsibility for management and control of those assets in terms of knowing what, when, where, how, and doing a process check for
not
evidence?
There's not one. Each engineering group is helping with that. Like in the LS organization, they have the engineering group that is helping with that asset. We have the chief engineering group with the structures that is helping with those assets. We have the vehicle engineering group that is helping with the rail car assets. So this is not one.
I'm sorry, but I was going to say, in regards to that question, though, there is a group that reports to Mr. Bitar, that is an asset manager group that sets up the framework for all of the technology that needs to be in place. So we do have the asset manager grade group, which is the asset manager group, which sets up that framework to be able to provide that, you know, as a consistent sort of corporate standard that this is what you need to do. Here's the framework for it, the collection of the information. And, you know, what Mr. Bitar was talking about was, each individual engineering group is responsible for then looking at those assets based on their skill and knowledge, you know, of other.
And I ask the question, we've gone through such an enormous period of time that the blood, sweat, and tears that everyone in this room and everyone out there has gone through to approach a state of good repair and just wanting to understand what mechanisms we have in place that are going to assure us day in and day out that we are not going to be in that position ever, and that the only reason we get there is because we raise our hand and say, we know what's needed, we don't have the money to do it, you better supply it or otherwise, but we should never be in a position where we don't know, and I'm just trying to understand that we know and have a mechanism in place to ensure that we know.
Well, to Rob's point, the asset management group is formalizing this well. The individual engineering groups control and keep an eye on the actual assets and conditions, and they can formulate programs and replacement plans based on these surveys or condition assessments that they do periodically.
But the asset management group itself has an independent responsibility to satisfy itself that the asset is being protected,
tracked,
and improved based on what they know to be the requirements of investment and maintenance and all those kinds of things. Is that what I understand?
The baseline, yes, absolutely. The information, like on the 7000 series case, when the first cars are commissioned, then that group will receive the information and they will load it into the system. The system is going to have the baseline of it. And actually, the rail cars is a good example. It's pretty straightforward. And right there, we're going to have exactly what car is due for midlife on what year. In the case of other assets, like vertical transportation, condition assessment will play a role. We have a new escalator. It's going into the system. It has a baseline of 15 years. But with these routine assessments, that line of 15 years might be moved for that asset, depending on the conditions surrounding that particular asset, the duty cycle. An escalator in Metro Center will see a lot of wear and tear compared to the one up in College Park. You know, so.
Thank you very much for your report and your work. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Just want to follow up on that. In the other side of the coin, you know the assets, you've got their life, you've got the replacement cycle. But we know you don't go out on that piece of track's birthday and say, today you're going to get changed. But the other part of the process is coming up with an efficient plan to get the work done. Sometimes it may even be ahead of schedule. If you're going to be in a particular tunnel section, you might replace some track early. But you've got to have it all documented so that you don't leave any bad track behind.
Mr. Downs and Ms. Porter.
thank you again for doing this. I want to add on to Mr. Nichols' comment about this becoming institutionalized and suggest that part of having an annual KPI is a regular agreed-upon process that uses this as an end-of-year review of this state of good repair. I think this is an excellent way to tell the public to hold ourselves accountable for focusing on this set of issues, to have this be a part of an annual KPI at the end of the year so that it comes back, so that we know it always comes back. It's hard to find, it's hard to sort out at times in the final capital budget review at the end of the year, to close out. The other is a comment that I know it's more complex, but one of the most critical components doesn't have a steady state of maintenance, and that is train control trackside, which is where the authority failed miserably about understanding a replacement and upgrade cycle. And I would encourage you to think about how we might get to an understandable annual commitment to maintenance and upgrade of trackside train control. We need to at least look at it once a year to make sure that we're doing the right thing going forward. I know we'll have all new equipment, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't need a regular maintenance and replacement cycle. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Ms. Porter?
Thank you for the presentation. I also very much appreciate the graphics that you put together. I think they very, very clearly illustrate exactly what's going on, and I think they would be very helpful to the public in sort of understanding what we're doing, even more so if we went back a few years. I remember looking at similar graphics for earlier in the process, and there you can see the progress extremely dramatically because of all the work we've been doing for the past few years. And I don't know if it would... we could put it up on the website or whatever, but just make it available to people who, as Rob Troop said, you know, they don't see the shiny new rail or the shiny new fasteners or the all the new ties. It just looks like rail to them. And so if we did something that would show very clearly, as these graphics do, what the progress has been and what we've been doing all these weekends we've been closing the system, I think it would really help people to sort of understand it in a more detailed way.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Brown?
Thanks. And to build on what Ms. Porter said, I think it's especially important as we discuss the capital funding agreement. I mean, we're going to be talking about momentum and additional enhancements to the system, but I think what you've laid out is a baseline capital budget, if you will. Yes. So I'm curious how... Well, I'm glad we're going to have that story as we enter the capital funding agreement. But I'm also curious how this is going to feed into the capital budget process for the capital funding agreement and the even the next year's budget.
Sure. Okay. Any other questions? Not thank you, Mr. Bitar, for your presentation. And we'll move on to our final agenda item, which is the financial management oversight update. And we have Mr. And it's like Mr. Fishburne.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. The objective for this information item today is to provide you the monthly progress status update on Metro's committed corrective action plan items in response to the Federal Transit Administration's Financial Management Oversight Review Report, as well as the recent feedback we received from the FTA on some of the 30-day and 60-day cap submissions. At our last update to you on September 11th, we received a committee request for a dashboard-type report for monitoring our progress toward fulfillment of the specified FMO report recommendations. Today, I'm pleased to share our first dashboard report with the committee. We've taken a quadrant approach with information that includes, starting in the upper left corner, the previously presented status of our corrective action plans, with completion status risk mapped against the financial controls risk severity, and this is titled FMO cap status by finding. This section reflects that we have submitted 62 of the 65 originally committed caps. Of the three caps not yet submitted, we have an extension request in process for two of them, and the third has a due date set for June of next year. Counterclockwise from there, the FMO-related training, the lower left section, provides the numbers of employees who received training on our new policies and procedures in the areas of procurement, grants management, and asset management. The training curriculum for asset management is currently in development, and initial sessions should begin next month. The lower right quadrant identifies our progress toward fulfilling the FTA's 38 FMO recommendations corresponding to the 9 findings of material weaknesses and significant deficiencies. Now, this section warrants a brief explanation. First, the advisory comments are not included because they are not considered as either material or significant findings. Second, the FMO report clearly conveys that management responses to the advisory comments were not required. So there was no review or feedback on our voluntarily provided caps, and we will not receive any FDA responses to our caps associated with them. So with the advisory comments aside, we have 56 committed corrective action plans addressing the FDA's 38 recommendations associated with the 9 findings, which are 3 material weaknesses and 6 significant deficiencies. Our progress shown is that 54 caps have been submitted against the 38 recommendations, and so far, FDA has confirmed that of the caps reviewed to date, 14.5 recommendations have been adequately satisfied. The final quadrant in the upper right corner is a graphic illustrating our progress with respect to the quality and frequency of our grant drawdown submission packages since the restricted drawdown process was imposed in March. The blue bars represent the percentage of a given submission package's total value that was approved for reimbursement without follow-up information needed. As you can see, the rate of submission approvals has improved to a level that is almost consistently at 100%. The tighter grouping of the bars reflects the increased frequencies of our submissions more recently than earlier on. And lastly, the red line tracks the cumulative rate of successful approvals and reimbursements. The initial rate was 63% in March. As of the end of September, we've drawn 94% of the total dollars submitted for review. Now, this is a timeline update that reflects our corrective action plan submissions through the end of September. The 2 most recently submitted CAP items were transmitted on September 30th, and that was well in advance of their originally committed due dates. As of now, WMATA has submitted documentation for 62 of the 65 CAP items, completing our CAP submission commitments for 2 of the 3 material weaknesses, all 6 of the significant deficiencies, and 4 of the 5 advisory comments. Last week, we received 3 letters from FDA in response to our 30-day CAP follow-up submissions, our 60-day CAP submission, and our date extension request for 2 CAPs. Foremost, we received confirmation that our CAPs adequately satisfied 6 recommendations. We've been requested to provide reasonable and realistic date commitments back to FDA for both our date extension request and the process to ensure any overdrawn grants are repaid. And these are due within 30 days by October 31st. Also, the FDA responses included a request for 5 follow-up items to be provided in 2 weeks by October 15th. And these are on clarification of the process to properly report and draw down indirect costs, ensure our procurement training curriculum and delivery are properly qualified to ensure compliance with FDA procurement regulations, and make 3 updates to our procurement procedures manual regarding file completion and the job order contracting process. I want to close by reviewing our next steps. We will meet the FDA-requested deadlines for the 2-week and 30-day follow-ups. We will continue to diligently and exhaustively pursue all activities to maximize grant draws, review historical echo draws for accuracy, and complete the required grant reconciliations and associated budget amendments. And we are strengthening our internal compliance office to ensure completion of all corrective actions, full implementation and adherence to new procedures, and ongoing compliance with all applicable federal regulations. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks. I'll be happy to field any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fishburne. Are there any questions or comments from the committee? This is either Mr. Downey or Mr. Nichols.
So, Mr. Fishburne, I'd like to go back to the dashboard, if I might. First of all, thank you for trying to put what is a really complicated set of things into a single page. And let me just say up front, one of my responsibilities is to report back to the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, who's very interested in are we making progress. And so I'm looking at it through the lens of those folks who don't deal in the world that we live in all the time. So these are comments offered in the spirit of helping us communicate it more clearly possibly. So anytime I have to give as much explanation as you did about the completion of the FTA recommendations, I've lost all of them. And they're going to focus on the fact that one chart says 54 caps and the other one says 65. And so we need to make a decision about what we're going to do about that, because they'll just be confused, and I'll spend a lot of time telling them those other ones didn't really matter. Well, how come they're up there in the red, yellow, green? So we need to figure that out and figure out how to align it so that I don't have to spend time explaining that every time they look at it. On the number of participants in the training, is this the total universe of people that we are required or that we promise to train, this 448 for procurement and 267 for grants management?
Well, we on the procurement, we're covering anybody who really has procurement responsibility, we're covering with that. And in the grants management, that includes not only the our finance and accounting and support administrative functions, but the project management community as well.
So here's what I think I want to know. Is everybody who needs this training, has everybody who needs this training received it? And I can't tell that just with numbers. I need a bar chart that fills up. And because we're committing to doing this periodically, there needs to be some way that you refresh this periodically. Because I'm mindful of the fact that we have monitoring responsibility moving forward. And so how you help us understand that we're complying with the training requirements for the people is actually, to me, really important. I love the draw submission one. That one doesn't need any explanation. And then I guess you've got a little green bar down, or a little green dot down here in the training that says asset management. We don't have anybody trained in asset management?
As I tried to explain in my remarks, that the asset management curriculum is still in development, and we expect to start that training next month.
Okay. So really, three bars would be a lot easier than a circle that isn't really the entirety of the people that we have to train. The last question really does go to the long term, and I didn't review what we all committed we would do as a monitoring function. But I guess that's really the next challenge for you, is what are the metrics that we feel set us up to be able to monitor as appropriately the procurement and the grants functions. And so this is about the FMO, but we need something else that is about ongoing monitoring.
Right. And we have described some metrics and reporting that we're going to do in our quarterly reports.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Downey?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the report and the amount of work that's gone in over the last 6 months to get us where we are. I want to look where we're going, and as Ms. Hines had spoken, some things we need to be doing shorter term and some things we really need to be doing longer term. On the short term, I particularly want to focus on the two caps that have not yet been agreed to. I'm pleased that FTA is saying a reasonable and realistic date. That's still going to be in the eye of the beholder. But with 6 months of experience under our belt, I hope we can actually set a reasonable and realistic date for cleaning up the old grants and the overdraw issues based on what it's taken to get to where we are and what we can literally say, here's the work plan to get the rest of the way. It may or may not seem reasonable and realistic to FTA, but I think it would be helpful if we know before it's given to them what that time frame will be. So if they come back like a nuclear explosion, we'll say, no, it really has been worked through, and this is realistically and reasonably what it will take. But I think we've built up a pretty good degree of confidence with them, but it's trust but verify as far as they're concerned. So let's hear what it's due in 30 days. Give us an advance before it goes to them as to what it is. Is that okay?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The other, I'd like to look beyond the FMO to the broader issue of the board's role in fiscal oversight. we didn't do our job well. We need to be able to do that. I'd like to begin a dialogue over the next couple of months on how do we document and fully understand the board's role and the staff's role. We're going to have a lot of changes at the staff level. We're going to have a lot of potential changes at the board level. I think we need to get on paper our learning experience. What are the roles of the board? What's the role of the CFO, the controller, the treasurer, general counsel, the outside auditors, the IG, sort of who does what on what kind of time schedule. I think we also should document what is the cycle at which we look at things. Budget performance reports come in on, sometimes you think, haven't seen one in a long time, then a couple come in. I think we need to know when we will see them. And the other thing I'd like to put out, I know it will be difficult, but I don't think we should just rely once a year on the financials that get done at the end of the year. We really do need to be seeing quarterly financials, unaudited, but at least some. Because there are certain things you don't know from budget performance. You've got to see the financials to know where we are with respect to cash, where we are with respect to, and there may be other issues. And I think we should also have agreement within both budget performance and financials and other things like grant drawdowns. What are the kind of red lines we should be looking at? That if something drops to a certain point, we all know that it's something that needs to be looked at. I don't expect to do this, see this overnight. I think, but we need to work on it over the next couple of months. It's this committee, it's the audit committee, and others. But I think going forward, we've got to have the tools to do the job that we need to do. So when you have a proposal kind of on how to get this done, I would very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. Mr. Nichols?
Thank you. Thank you for the report. And I a couple of questions, a couple of observations, and a couple of points that actually relate to what both Mort and Mary shared and thought about. First off, I too thank you for the dashboard. Our new CFO, Mr. Anasicki, kindly invited each of the board members to have a one-on-one with him when first came on, and which I really appreciate and respect. And was one of the first things I asked for, and I discussed that with Blair as well, it's that dashboard, and I really appreciate your doing that. It helps a lot to illuminate and give us some perspective on what's happening. And clearly, we're doing a ton of work. Couple of thoughts. One is we are accomplishing an enormous amount of work in a short period of time with crisis management resources, with drawing in and a wide array of resources, concentrated effort, a response to multiple audits and just findings of things that need to get fixed. So part one is exactly what we're doing and you're doing, is to understand it, get it mapped out, and to do it. The point that Mary is raising with respect to putting that dashboard out there, we're evidencing that we're meeting the requirements as imposed upon us by external organizations, and that's a good thing. We need to design reports or ways that we as a board can properly exercise our role from a governance standpoint to know that we fully understand the variables in a way that when they're not being met, we can understand that. What I'd really like to have a little bit of discussion about with to hear both Dennis, you, and Blair in terms of your own thoughts is what is the cultural, organizational change that's taking place that needs to take place, not just putting the rules in the operation. What is it that you're experiencing? What are we doing that's to change the overall business that we're doing, and how are we approaching that? And we're approaching by the fundamentals, but talk a little bit about your experience and what you're, how that's coming along. It's really more of listening to you and your thoughts and perspectives on where it's been, where it is, what you're doing, and how the environment. It's not a trick question. I know it's an evolving process, but I really would just like to understand the environment and what's happening to change the culture and the way of doing business.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. From the perspective of someone who's been here less than 90 days, I think for me, it has been educational.
And painful.
I think the scope of the challenges, along with all of the usual and customary activities that we as an organization need to undertake to make sure we have the right level of service on the street and to comply with the demands of the FMO review has been quite significant. That said, I think at least in the finance organization and particularly with our interactions with our business partners across the organization, my sense is that there is a clear recognition in terms of what the operating process ought to be going forward, partly because of we have had to rely on them, for the most part, to understand what happened and to try to reconstruct both the facts and the reports that we need to provide to indicate that we are being much more compliant going forward. I think culturally, it is going to take some time to get there, and it's going to take training, not just in finance, but across the organization. But I think the first diagnosis is that, you know, we need to figure out what's wrong. And we know as an organization that we are required to adhere to certain code of conduct, particularly when it comes to respect to not just FTA, but also the citizens who fund the organization. And that is clear. So the team that has been responding to this clearly are burdened across the spectrum. Because to meet the requirements of the audit, for example, to meet the requirements of the triennial, which we just went through, to meet the requirements of setting up the budget process, imposes some deadlines and some constraints in terms of board's capacity and performance. What we are all struggling with is to make sure that we are cognizant of the priorities both now and for the future, as we try to address the immediate problems of cleaning up the deck and setting up, resetting, if you will, the foundations. But I'll have Blair speak to some of those challenges.
Clearly, with our all these corrective action plans we've designed and authored and put in place, there's a lot of procedural change that has to go on in the organization. And it, you know, I think we're clearly recognizing it within the finance and accounting function. And I think it's, I think we're seeing, you know, recognition throughout the operations function as well. It's a big community. I'm not sure we've gotten everyone bought in right away, but I do think that we're seeing some, we're still in a lot of cleanup mode still. So we haven't, I think it's a little early to start making any judgments or assessments as to, you know, whether people who are submitting, you know, new invoice package and voucher packages are, you know, are really following and complying with all the requirements. I think clearly the word's out. Everybody understands. Everybody, you know, we've done a lot of training. We've had a lot of conversations. I hear people saying, you know, these are new processes and it's, you know, it's a new day and we're doing things differently. But I think it's something we have to measure over time. And, you know, cultural change certainly doesn't come overnight. I do know that that the leadership and operations is invested and right there along with us with the changes we want to make and all the requirements that we're putting in place. You know, I think we're making progress. I wouldn't say we're there yet.
Well, I appreciate the candor and the perspective that both of you have, and I ask the question for a couple of reasons. One is, it's clear that these things will take time, and as has been expressed by all, by board members and others, the notion of accountability is something that we have to re-examine what we define as accountability, how we exercise it. At the same time, and our expectations of that, at the same time, I know that I'm not the only board member who feels this way. We want to evidence our support of the team that is exercising these jobs, and not to be punitive, but to be supportive, because it's a tough job and we're all responsible for it. And while we are all frustrated with where we are, it's clearly important that we demonstrate that we are supportive of the challenge of what's going on and what has to be invested personally and professionally by everyone who's doing it. And so just wanted to get a little insight into the culture and the experience that's happening. And I think that the last piece on this really relates to establishing our competency around this, that it's a great time to be able to strengthen our relationships and the confidence that our stakeholders have in us, because our pants are all pulled down, and that's a good thing. And I think that everyone knows what the circumstance is, but I think everyone is clearly invested in the change and in the success. So I know that I don't speak just for Maryland or other jurisdictions as well. I know that there's a lot of collaboration that goes on between, you know, professionals in this business across the board, and I know that we can leverage whatever guidance and sharing from our jurisdictional stakeholders as well, sharing information. I think that a consistency in terms of transparency with where we are will help them to understand better the nature of what you're going through right now to make the change, not to take you away from the task, but to be able to, through whatever mechanisms necessary, as Mary talked about, to be able to evidence that we don't have a solution to all the problems yet, but we have a plan to get there, and we understand what they are, and we're on our way there, just so that we can continue to build the confidence that we've wrapped our arms around this thing and are moving forward. I think that will be really helpful, and again, everyone is supportive of this thing that we have here. We just need to stay at it, and thank you for your report, and thanks for responding to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for staff? No, thank you for the presentation and update. And if there are no other matters to be brought before this committee, this meeting is adjourned.